You're listening to Precinct 444, a podcast network from the National Law Enforcement Museum. Today we're bringing you an episode from Law and Disorder, where we dive into the world of true crime stories with memorable cases that have lasting effects for law enforcement.
On April 20th, 1999, two members of Columbine High School's senior class opened fire on their classmates, embarking on a reign of terror that reached a magnitude unlike anything the American public had ever seen before. Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold committed what would, for many years, be considered the deadliest K-12 shooting in American history, claiming the lives of 12 students and one teacher, and injuring 20 others, all before ending their own lives in the school library, surrounded by many of their victims. Today, many school shootings on high school, college, and even elementary school campuses have surpassed the carnage that happened at Columbine. On December 14, 2012, 26 people were murdered at Sandy Hook Elementary School. 20 of them were 6- and 7-year-old first graders, and the rest were 4 teachers, the school's principal, and the school's psychologist. An even more recent tragedy took place on May 24, 2022, in Uvalde, Texas, where 19 students, aged 9 to 11, were murdered along with 2 teachers. Columbine was not the first school shooting to happen in the United States. One of the first recorded mass casualty events in an American school actually took place in 1764 in Greencastle, Pennsylvania, which took place during the Pontiac's War. So it's slightly contested as to whether or not it could be considered in complement to events of today. But the first event that we would really consider to be a quote-unquote school shooting among the likes of Columbine actually took place on August 1st, 1966 at the University of Texas in Austin, where 25-year-old engineering student and former U.S. Marine Charles Whitman ascended to the top of the university's clock tower and fired upon fellow students for 96 minutes from the observation deck. He killed 15 and injured 31 on campus before he was ultimately killed by police. The group Everytown for Gun Safety, which has tracked incidents of gunfire in schools, cites that there have been over 1,200 such incidents, which have resulted in over 400 deaths and over 900 other injuries. But why do we still talk about Columbine over any of the school shootings that happened before it? There are a number of reasons why Columbine was, quote, different. Some of these reasons are easier to see than others. At its most simple, Columbine was the beginning of a pattern of school shootings that we didn't see until it was far too late. Part of that comes from the fact that some more recent school shooters have cited Columbine as an inspiration for their own atrocities. But there are other reasons, too. Media coverage of the tragedy played a very key role. The 1990s were a time where crime was a hot topic of conversation on television. Think about the riots in LA after the death of Rodney King and the O.J. Simpson trial. It's no denying that unspeakable tragedy is the bread and butter of the 24-hour news cycle. In today's episode, I don't want to spend the entire episode going through what happened in the halls of Columbine High School 25 years ago. There are plenty of books and documentaries out there that can tell you nearly minute-by-minute breakdowns of the tragedy that happened that morning in Littleton, Colorado. And an outsider, especially one who was 3 years old when Columbine happened, retelling tragedies like Columbine in great detail really doesn't do anything but throw salt into an already infected, traumatic wound that has yet to heal a quarter of a century later. Instead, I want to talk about why we're still talking about Columbine 25 years later, both in our society and in the field of law enforcement. There are a lot of lessons that Columbine taught us, and we, unfortunately, continue to learn these lessons the hard way as more and more students die from gun violence in American schools each year. One of the greatest lessons comes from the fact that Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold planned what they called Judgment Day for more than 2 years without anyone really knowing. And there were warning signs that were caught in hindsight, but unfortunately, hindsight is 20/20, and at the end of the day, 13 innocent lives were lost, and an entire country was forever changed, and that is what we will get into now. So So starting with the law enforcement field, we're still talking about Columbine a quarter of a century later because Columbine illuminated the need for a distinct change in the law enforcement response to active shooter situations. In 1999, law enforcement's primary response in the event of a school shooting was to assemble a perimeter around the area, communicate with dispatch to determine where in the school the shooter was, and then wait for SWAT to respond and infiltrate the school. This is the exact procedure that was used at Columbine. Jefferson County law enforcement officers established a perimeter around the school and waited for SWAT officers to go in, find the shooters, and bring an end to the shooting if it had not been ended already. Columbine taught us that this was not the most effective solution to save student lives and stop a shooting as soon as possible. It showed law enforcement that prioritizing entry to the school, location of the shooter, and getting students and staff out of the school and away from the shooter as quickly as possible is most important. Today, law enforcement officers at all levels, local, state, and federal, are typically trained in response to active shooter situations, whether they will ever have to use that knowledge or not. These officers are trained to assess the situation and, if possible, waste no time entering the building. As we have seen in situations like the shooting at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, we do know that this training is not always executed in an ideal way. Above that, each department and agency will have its own version of active shooter training, so no one policy is going to be identical to another. However, in the 25 years after Columbine, the standard best practice for first responders is to enter the school first and then establish a perimeter, as opposed to how it was done in 1999. As a whole, our society still talks about Columbine for several reasons. The most glaring is the tragic loss of life and the fact that there was no clear motive for the attack from the shooters. At the time, and subsequently for nearly two decades, Columbine was the deadliest shooting to ever occur at an American high school. This was only surpassed in 2018 by the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. 12 students, Rachel Scott, Daniel Rohrbaugh, Kyle Velasquez, Stephen Kurnow, Cassie Bernal, Isaiah Scholes, Matthew Kechter, Lauren Townsend, John Tomlin, Kelly Fleming, Daniel Mauser, and Corey DePooter, as well as one teacher, William David Sanders, were all senselessly murdered at Columbine in cold blood. While it was circulated through the media that the shooters were targeting the school's varsity athletes or anyone wearing quote-unquote white hats with sports logos, which was perceived as a sign of popularity at the time, the shooters really went into Columbine High School that morning with no agenda other than killing as many students as possible before turning their guns on themselves. It is not believed by law enforcement that all of the killings were racially motivated, especially considering that the shooters and most of their victims were white. However, in the library, witnesses did state that Isaiah Scholes, who was the only African-American victim, had been taunted with racial slurs by the shooters before he was ultimately murdered by Eric Harris. From the analysis of primary sources left behind by the killers, including journals, documents, web pages created by the shooters, and the cryptic basement tapes that have never been shown to the public, investigators ultimately concluded that the shooting had been planned as a terrorist attack, where the shooters intended to kill as many of their classmates as possible. Media speculation in the wake of the shooting suggested a number of unsubstantiated theories as to why the shooters would have perpetrated the atrocity. These included violent video games, like 1993's Doom, and violent movies, like 1994's Natural Born Killers, which glorified the actions of vigilante killers and criminals, as well as bullying, goth culture, and even the music of Marilyn Manson. But Columbine also introduced a wider conversation about the importance of prioritizing the mental health of our youth and identifying destructive behaviors of potential shooters to stop school shootings before they occur. It is widely publicized in the wake of the Columbine shootings, the red flags that were missed by authoritative figures in the shooters' lives in the years before the shootings ever happened. Both of the shooters had various mental health struggles, most notably depression. As early as 1997, Eric Harris's father, Wayne, had noticed changes in his son's mental state and referred his son for treatment. And we know that Eric Harris was being treated with antidepressants at the time of the shooting. Dylan Klebold was a typical depressive teenager, and the entries in his journals corroborate this. While both shooters had been caught by their parents doing typical rebellious teenage behaviors, like sneaking alcohol and minor marijuana possession, for the most part, there were few run-ins with the law and school administration. However, there were a few instances to note. The pair had been caught stealing from the school's computer room just before they were notably arrested on January 30, 1998, by police for stealing audio equipment from a van. The two were sentenced to a youth diversion program, and both passed through the program without incident. There were other red flags that rose eyebrows of teachers and fellow students, but at the time there was no clear indication that the behaviors would lead to a mass shooting. In February of 1998, deputies found a pipe bomb near the Harris home, but it had not detonated, and there was no real way to trace it back to Harris or Klebold. And later that spring, Wayne Harris caught his son in their home with a pipe bomb, similar to the ones that were used during the Columbine shooting. In March 1998, Dylan had mentioned death threats from Eric to a classmate named Brooks Brown, but neither one of them mentioned it to an adult. Additionally, in November of 1998, Eric Harris turned in a concerning assignment for a class that was written about Nazis in incredibly graphic detail. This concerned the teacher, but it was not reported otherwise. In retrospect, these behaviors would be cries for help to be taken seriously as a warning sign of a potential active shooter. But it brings a new point into the conversation as well about how complacent bystanders are in these kinds of incidents. Earlier this year, the parents of a Michigan teen who shot and killed four students at Oxford High School in 2021 were sentenced to 10 years in prison for their failure to prevent their child from committing a mass killing, and even potentially enabling their child after concerning text messages were made public in the wake of the shooting. While the parents of the Columbine shooters were publicly scrutinized, and others, like teachers who found that assignment, and friends who had heard threats but didn't say anything, faced some public backlash, they faced no criminal charges. And this brings into the question what we call the arc of accountability, and it's a new area of discourse in the term of school shootings. But beyond what is outwardly seen and missed in the Columbine case, which sparked conversations about the importance of teen mental health, were the journals that were left behind by the shooters. Journals that were kept in secret by the shooters and only discovered by investigators, who were trying desperately to put together the pieces after an immense tragedy. It is a fairly common phenomenon in post-Columbine school shootings that the shooter leaves behind some kind of document trail to give those left behind an idea of why the shooting happened. It was very clear from the shooter's journal entries that the shootings were intricately planned, and that severe teenage depression may have played a distinct role in the motivations behind going through with the plan to murder innocent classmates. In addition to the journal entries, the infamous basement tapes, which were recorded by Eric and Dylan in the month before the shooting and have never been released to the public, showed teenagers in crisis. In a short FBI documentary titled Echoes of Columbine, the FBI believes that 25% of school shooters have a mental health diagnosis, while 61% have some kind of mental issue that may or may not have been addressed clinically, and over 90% have a suicidal ideation. This was true in the case of Columbine. From journal entries alone, it was known that at least one of the two shooters, in this case it was Dylan Klebold, had suffered from suicidal ideation. And one of the most unlikely voices in the conversation about teen mental health awareness in the wake of the Columbine tragedy is actually Dylan Klebold's mother, Sue, who advocates for mental health awareness, research, and suicide prevention. In 2016, she published a memoir titled A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy, to inform other parents, families, and communities on the lessons she unfortunately learned in a very difficult way. She walks through the warning signs of depression that she missed in her son and the changes in behavior that she originally took for a moody teenager, and ultimately the repercussions that these mistakes made on our society as a whole. Throughout the book, speaking engagements, documentary films, and a very enlightening TED Talk, Sue Klebold's advocacy in the wake of her son's monstrosity is making our schools and societies safer. It is also key to note that she addresses on her website that all the proceeds from the book go to fund charitable organizations, including Mental Health America, which is MHA, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, which is the AFSP, American Association of Suicidology, which is AAS, and the Brain and Behavior Research Foundation. It is the reality that Columbine left a festering wound on our society that refuses to heal 25 years later. It showed us our vulnerability remains, even in the places where we should feel most safe. No parent should worry about whether their child will come home from school at the end of each day, and no student should worry about whether one of their classmates has brought a gun to school. Though it is important to note that while we hear about school shootings often, they are still incredibly rare events. However, it leaves us wondering when enough is finally going to be enough. Will we still be talking about Columbine as actively on its 30th anniversary in 2029? What about its 50th anniversary in 2049? That is up for us to decide. It is also up to us to take the lessons that Columbine so suddenly put in front of us and actually take the time to learn them, rather than pushing them off to be the next generation's cross to bear. There are a lot of scholars that are studying the epidemic of gun violence in American schools and American society, and their work heavily influenced the content of today's episode. The Washington Post has an incredible repository of statistics that date back to 1999. Some of the most comprehensive data regarding school shootings actually lives in the Center for Homeland Defense and Security School Shooting Database. It's an open-source database which provides links to relevant data on and analysis of gun violence in American primary and secondary schools from reputable sources. Additionally, psychological and sociological research is being done to understand the motivations of school shooters and even potential school shooters and understand the links between mental illness, previous trauma, and school shootings. I looked at information from these research areas in putting together today's episode, and each area could easily have its own episode, if not its own series, which should be done by people who are far more qualified than myself. But these are areas of interest to do research on your own if you find yourself with more questions. Additionally, I am a reader, and I read a lot of books when I put these episodes together. Two books that I use to gain a good understanding of what happened at Columbine High School and why it's important include Columbine, which was written by Dave Cullen and published in 2009 by 12, which is part of Hachette Book Group. The second book is A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy, which was written by Sue Klebold and published in 2016 by Penguin Random House. Sue Klebold has been on a relentless pursuit to understand the horror of her son's actions since that fateful day in 1999. I read the book for the first time when it was released, and it's one that continues to stick with me years later. She describes her grief as a parent and her shock at her son's actions without once making excuses for his incredibly horrific actions, both leading up to and on April 20th of 1999. Earlier this month, I had a conversation with Scarlett Lewis, who was the mother of Jesse Lewis, one of the first graders who was murdered at Sandy Hook Elementary School. She now leads Jesse Lewis Choose Love Movement. And that movement focuses on teaching love and the importance of mental health to prevent such tragedies. She praised Sue Klebold's work, remarking on how both she and Klebold, both mothers on very opposite sides of similar tragedies, could come to the same conclusion. Prioritizing the mental health of our youth can truly prevent atrocities like Columbine and Sandy Hook from ever happening. If you're listening to today's episode as it's released, we're premiering our newest public program on April 26th, 2024 at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, entitled Picking Up the Pieces, How Law Enforcement and Communities Rebuild After Mass Casualty Events. This program is moderated by our Deputy Director of Officer Safety and Wellness, Matthew Garcia, who you've heard on Precinct 444 before, and it features Scarlett Lewis as one of our panelists, along with representatives from ATF, FBI, and other areas of the law enforcement field to discuss the lessons that law enforcement and communities have learned in the 25 years since Columbine. They talk about how these two areas can work together and build back their communities after mass casualty events. The discussion between these panelists is incredibly important, and I highly encourage you to join us for the premiere, or check for the video on our YouTube channel, Facebook page, or our website at any time after April 26th. You can find out more about Picking Up the Pieces and other programs at www.nleomf.org/museum/public-programs. As always, I thank you for listening to today's episode of Law & Disorder and the Precinct 444 podcast. Remember to subscribe to stay up to date on all episode releases, which happen every other Wednesday. And if you find yourself in Washington, D.C., please consider paying a visit to the National Law Enforcement Museum. We're located at 444 East Street Northwest, just down from Judiciary Square on the Metro's Red Line, and we're open every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. We'd love to see you in person. Until next time, stay safe, and we'll see you again soon at the precinct.
Please subscribe to Precinct 444 on your favorite podcasting platform to stay connected and to receive our latest content as soon as it drops. We would love to hear from you. Send in your questions, comments, and feedback to precinct444@nleomf.org. You can help us make our content even better. The National Law Enforcement Museum is located at 444 East Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., and is dedicated to telling the story of American law enforcement. We expand and enrich the relationship between law enforcement and the community through educational journeys, immersive exhibitions, and insightful programs. Find us online at lawenforcementmuseum.org and stay tuned for more podcast content from Precinct 444. Until next time, stay safe. We'll see you at the precinct.